Dr. Eric Chivian speaking at the annual Harvard Medical School lectures on biodiversity and human health. This is where we find out how things like climate change and toxins affect not only our world, but our own selves personally. The lecture was given February 16, 2006.
It's a little intimidating to be giving a lecture on biodiversity after Ed Wilson. It's something like doing a presentation on how to paint with Rembrandt sitting in the front row, but I will press ahead. It's also a bit embarrassing as I'm still showing slides, and my teacher and mentor, who is at least chronologically an older dog than I, has moved into the 21st century while I still remain stuck in the early 20th. I have a feeling that Paul and Dan and Howard and Kat have put Ed up to this and are really trying to publicly humiliate me into getting me to change. Is this true? This just might work. Nothing else has worked, Ed, but this might do it. This might do it. Anyway, I will cover in this lecture some of the driving forces for species loss. You'll see a lot of stuff that's very familiar, since you've heard some of it in the last lecture, and it's no surprise since Ed has been my teacher for many years. And I'm going to spend a little extra time on climate change, as it's becoming fast one of the most important factors in species extinctions and ecosystem disruption, and as our traditional way of protecting biodiversity and conserving ecosystems, namely to kind of rope off terrestrial and marine habitats to preserve them, which is certainly clearly very important to allow nature to recover and to preserve its systems, but it's not going to work in many areas in the face of ever rapidly expanding global environmental changes that does not respect boundaries. So after that, I'm going to talk about the loss of potential medicines, loss of medical research models, and the disruption of ecosystem services. And finally, we'll talk a bit about what each of us can do to try to help conserve biodiversity. So the reading for this lecture is the interim executive summary of our book. The old name was Biodiversity, Its Importance to Human Health. The new title for the book is Sustaining Life, How Human Health Depends on Biodiversity. And I hope to turn the final manuscript into Oxford in a couple of weeks, inshallah. And that means God willing in Arabic, for those of you who are not familiar with that term. And I'm delighted to say that Professor Wilson has written the foreword of this book, and Kofi Annan has written the prologue, and there are more than 100 co-authors and reviewers and advisors and others who've been involved in its preparation. We very much hope it will make an important contribution to this field. So stay tuned. We think it's going to come out by the end of the year. Now, why should we be studying what's happening to other species? Well, because as you've just heard Professor Wilson say, we're losing species at an unprecedented rate, some 100, maybe even 1,000, and as he said today, in maybe in certain instances up to 10,000 over time's natural background levels. These are levels that can be calculated before humans came onto the Earth. These are rates that have not been seen since the last great Cretaceous extinction some 65 million years ago, when dinosaurs were largely wiped out. And the other importance is that with extinction, whether it is of a gene or a species or a population or of an ecosystem, this is the only truly irreversible effect of environmental degradation. Once a gene or a species is lost, it's essentially gone forever. By studying other species, we may also identify future health threats to ourselves, as some species are much more sensitive to environmental assaults than others. For example, we can look at endocrine disruptors or reproductive disruptors caused by pollutants. It's much harder, as you've heard Howard Hu talk about, to do this with epidemiologic studies in humans. And also because by looking at the dependency of human health on biodiversity, we may help many people, I think very many people, understand their connection to the environment and help develop the motivation to preserve it. So before starting, I want to make four quick points. The first is that human activity, even in the very early days of human beings, has been responsible for species extinctions way before modern times. There's good evidence that humans caused mass extinctions in Australia some 50,000 years ago, and across the Americas some 12,000 years ago. Humans wiped out large flightless birds and giant sloth-like marsupials and mammoths, of course. Native Americans almost wiped out the bison. The difference between then and now is the enormous difference in rate and magnitude and scope of species loss, so that now extinctions are worldwide, not just regional or local in scope. Second point is that you'll hear a lot about species extinctions, but it's important to understand that a species doesn't have to go extinct to greatly affect the functioning of an ecosystem, that this can occur if there's an enormous drop in population. An example of this is the Chesapeake Bay. 100 years ago, there were so many oysters in the Chesapeake Bay that they completely filtered the volume of the bay in 3 days. The oyster population has reduced so much in the last 100 years that it now takes a year, 100 times longer, for them to filter the bay. And as a result, the Chesapeake is poorly oxygenated and muddy and polluted. The good news is that it's recovering with some major policy changes. The third thing is that it's important to recognize that we're not just talking about the tropics or about tropical rainforests when we're talking about species loss. We're seeing major losses in temperate parts of the world as well. And if I can do the first slide, second slide. This is a Nature Conservancy study of the United States showing those states where there's the greatest number of species that are either missing or at risk of extinction or presumed extinct. It turns out that these numbers are some 2 to 3% of the known species numbers in the United States, and there are estimates that some 30% of U.S. species in various groupings are at risk, particularly aquatic species. Many of you don't realize how incredibly biologically diverse our country is. For example, we have the largest collection of salamanders in the world. We have the largest collection of freshwater turtles in the world, freshwater mussels in the world. We're second only to China in the diversity of conifers. So the United States is an enormously diverse country, and temperate zones are enormously diverse, certainly in the forest floor that Ed showed you in that slice of soil in Central Park. Certainly microbially, there's enormous diversity, much of which may be at risk, and we don't know about that. As Ed said, also that there are some 1.7 to 1.8 million species that have been identified that has given Latin names, but there may be 10 times more than that, there may be 100 times more than that. We have no idea, especially for inaccessible parts of the planet like the deep oceans, where new species are being discovered all the time, and certainly for the microbial world. There's a new sea squid that's 23 feet in length that was just discovered a couple of years ago at the bottom of the ocean. Even a new whale, new primates are being discovered all the time. This incredible little fish called the rosy-lipped batfish was recently discovered. This is related to the red-lipped batfish off the coast of Costa Rica. That's a pretty incredible organism, you've got to admit. And if we count bacteria, we have no idea even to the nearest order of magnitude. There may be 10 million, there may be 100 million. There are some estimates that I've seen that there are a billion bacterial species. We have absolutely no idea. The Forsyth Dental Research Institute, which is right down the block, there are people there that are looking at microbial species in the human mouth. They've identified 700 different microbial species that live in our mouths. Most of these are bacteria, but there are also archaea and fungi and protozoa. There are over 500 species that live in our small and large intestine. So the diversity of this world, which has been around, as you know, for billions of years longer than the eukaryotes, is enormous. Now, when Homo sapiens evolved some 150 to 190,000 years ago, the number of species on Earth was the largest ever. But as you've heard, we're reducing these numbers quite dramatically. And the causes of species extinction are many, as you've heard Professor Wilson. Of course, there is habitat destruction and degradation and fragmentation for agriculture, for grazing, for palm oil plantations, for development, especially in species-rich areas like tropical rainforests. But climate change, as I mentioned, is also predicted to cause widespread extinctions, and there is a great deal of concern that by direct effects and by complexity of indirect effects, by changing temperature, by changing precipitation patterns, that climate change may become one of the greatest causes of species extinction in coming years. Now let's look at this issue for a moment. You recall this slide of temperatures, average mean global surface temperatures for the last 20,000 years, and this big spike. This is an old IPCC estimate. The new one goes all the way up to 5.8 degrees centigrade as an upper limit of warming. What's important about this is not just the amount of warming, which is certainly very important, but in terms of species survival, it's the rate of warming. And these rates are some 10 to 100 times greater than they have been in the past. These temperature changes occurred over thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. We're talking about changes like this occurring in 100 years. Now, why is this important? Well, if you look at the fossil record, you can see that one of the dominant factors in species loss was climate change, both warming and cooling, directly because the temperature shifts were outside of the ranges that species could adapt to, and indirectly because of habitat change, the formation of glaciers, the drop in sea levels, etc. Now, when there was warming, and we can see this again from the fossil record, species moved towards the poles or to higher altitudes. And when there was cooling, they moved back towards the equator and to sea level. And when the species couldn't shift their ranges fast enough, they were lost, either because the rates were too slow or because there were various barriers, like I mentioned, blocking their advance. So we're talking about changes over a very rapid period of time. And what is this going to, what kind of challenges is this going to put in the way of species? And also there are all these barriers that we have made in the way of these migrations, roads and cities and farms, which didn't exist, obviously, in the distant past. Species at very high latitudes, which have maybe no place to go because they can't get higher in latitude, or species at very high altitudes at the top of mountains because they have no place to migrate to, are at particular risk. So, but it's also important for us to realize that we're not talking, species don't live in isolation in ecosystems. They live in a whole community of other species that they depend on for their food, that they compete with, that are predators of them, that they are predators of. And so we're talking about whole ecosystems having to migrate together, which, as you can imagine, is a pretty complicated and difficult thing to imagine, where all species are equally going to be able to move as a unit. There are also other changes. For example, if you look at sugar maples, which is an area of big interest, personal interest to me, because I own a small sugar bush in central Massachusetts from which we make sugar maple syrup. And we're at the very bottom now of the sugar maple range. So with warming, the range of sugar maples in 100 years, I can't remember the time period, but is it on here? Anyway, the projected range with increased temperature, that the range is going to move up. The current range is yellow, and the new range is blue, and the overlapping range is green. But this assumes that the moisture levels are the same. If you have decreased moisture in the soil, which is certainly likely with warming, this is the present range of sugar maples, and this is the new range, and this is the overlap. So there are many other factors with this migration that will also be true. Now, recall that in the last 100 years, we've talked about, you've seen this before, the warming of about 0.6 degrees centigrade on average globally, or 1 degree Fahrenheit. So we have to ask the question, are we seeing evidence of migrations of species now? And the answer seems to be yes. This beautiful butterfly is called the Edith's checker spot butterfly, and people have watched butterflies and birds because they love them so much and tracked their ranges for 100 years, especially in places like Britain. But in the West, many people have studied this butterfly for quite a while, and they have found that its range is shifting towards the North Pole, shifting northward. And the same is true when you look at vascular plants in the Alps, which are moving up in elevation in the Alps. Now, these kinds of shifts have major implications for things like vector-borne infectious diseases, because we may see shifts in vectors and hosts as well that carry disease. While there are other ways that global warming and global climate change may threaten species, this is an enormous subject. There's a new book by Tom Lovejoy and Lee Hanna on this subject by Yale University Press. I'll go very quickly through them because I want to get to the health impacts. Coral bleaching, you've heard about, you'll hear more about. Corals are very sensitive. They live at the extreme edge of their temperature range, so when there's warming of even as much as 1 degree centigrade over that temperature limit, they can lose their algae that they depend on, their photosynthetic algae, and bleach and become very sensitive to infectious diseases. You'll hear more about this from Ray Hayes. Professor Wilson has mentioned the golden toad. This is was found in Monteverde cloud forest in the mountain of Costa Rica. It's presumed to be extinct. The last one was observed in 1989. The theory is that warming changed the habitat of the cloud forest and made the golden toad, as well as a large number of species of what are called harlequin frogs, the genus is Atelopus, more sensitive and more vulnerable to a fungal infection. So these are very complicated dynamics that you can see. When you change temperatures in ecosystems, you can change a whole series of relationships, and these frogs seem to have died from this, what's called a chytrid fungal infection, and went extinct. Amphibians are very threatened in many parts of the world, and it's a large topic that I won't go into right now. Another area is this whole issue of disconnection, because species co-evolve. So flowers co-evolve with their pollinators, and birds co-evolve with their food sources in moths and other insects and things like that. So species have spent thousands of eons co-evolving together. So when you change the temperature, one species' biological events may change in time at a different rate from a species that he co-evolved with. This is a study done in the Netherlands with a bird called the great tit. And here is 1980, and this is the time of hatching for the bird, and this is the time of the peak mass for its most important food, which is a moth, type of moth. And so with now, the date of hatching of the bird is the same. It hasn't changed because it does not respond to in the same way that the peak mass of the moth has responded, which is now moved up in time, May 15th. So when the birds are hatching, their major food source is not there for them. So these disconnects, these decouplings may have serious implications for species. And I'll very quickly go through other factors, which have to mention very quickly: ultraviolet radiation from thinning ozone, damaging DNA and proteins in many species. Pollutants have affected, we believe, the reproductive capacity of beluga whales in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and have also caused a variety of diseases. They bioaccumulate toxins like heavy metals, mercury and lead, as well as some pesticides. You'll hear more about this from Howard Hu and Phil Landrigan in coming weeks. Deformities also can be caused by pollutants, from agriculture pollutants. This was the big initial story of concern about amphibians showing up in Minnesota lakes with extra legs. It's a complicated story. Ultraviolet may be involved as well, and there's also a parasitic flatworm. It's too complicated to go into here, but again, these species obviously cannot escape predators and are at risk. Invasives that Ed mentioned, purple loosestrife is a big one in our state. You can see it. It's a very beautiful flower, but it's taking over wetlands and marshlands along sides of roads and all up and down places like Route 2. You can see large stands of this outcompeting other plants. Over-harvesting, over-fishing, over-harvesting for bushmeat. This is a murdered gorilla family in Africa, murdered for bushmeat or trophies or other reasons. Now, what does all this have to do with human health? Well, for one, with the loss of species, we're losing the possibility of developing new medicines. Because over the course of millions of years, species have evolved their own chemicals that fight their own tumors, their own infectious diseases, their own other diseases, and have also allowed them to capture prey and avoid being eaten. And some of these chemicals have become some of our most important pharmaceuticals. The cinchona tree, for example, has given us quinine and quinidine. Quinine was the first anti-malarial. Quinidine is a medicine for cardiac arrhythmias. There are many other medicines that have come from the rainforest, but they also have come from temperate species. Aspirin comes from the willow tree, for example. And the synthetic drugs, digoxin and digitoxin, come originally from digitalis, which comes from this beautiful flower called the foxglove. This is actually from my garden. And a survey has shown that some 57% of the 150 most prescribed drugs in the United States were derived from or were patterned after compounds derived from natural sources. So this is an enormously important area. Now let me mention two models of species that are endangered that have given us enormously important medicines. The first is this runted tree called the Pacific Yew, Taxus brevifolia. This was burned routinely in old growth logging because it amounted to nothing. It made no useful commercial product. But the Natural Products Branch of the National Cancer Institute did this massive screening of plants beginning in 1958. They screened 35,000 plant species to see if there were useful compounds, and they found in the bark of this runted tree a compound called Taxol. And they started testing it, and they found that it killed cancer cells with a very, very high degree of success. It was very potent. And they discovered also that it killed the cancer cells by a totally new mechanism that hadn't been known about before. It prevented what's called the disassembly of the mitotic spindle. You all remember these slides from high school or college biology, where the chromosomes align across the metaphase plate and they move up the spindle and then the cell divides. Well, the spindle is made of a protein called tubulin, and Taxol prevents the disassembly of this spindle. It stabilizes tubulin so that it doesn't get degraded for the next cell division, and therefore stops cell division. And some of the newer compounds based on Taxol, semi-synthetic and fully synthetic, were found to be even more potent chemotherapeutic agents. The original studies on Taxol were for ovarian cancer, which is a very difficult to treat cancer, partly because you discover it quite late in its course, unfortunately. But these new taxoids have also been very effective against breast cancer and other malignancies, including lung cancer and malignant melanoma. In fact, Taxol and taxoids are the best-selling, most lucrative chemotherapeutic agent in the country at the present time. Taxol has also been used to coat stents because, again, it prevented the growth of the what are called the endothelial cells in the inside of arteries, which end up regrowing around these baskets that keep arteries open for the coronaries. And coated stents were very useful in preventing this regrowth. Very important drug. Came from this little runted tree that nobody knew about, had any value whatsoever. How many other Pacific yews are we losing by taking down old growth in other forests? Another story, cone snails. These beautiful shells are from a very large genus of predatory snails that live mostly in the South Pacific. There are about 500 species. It's a very large genus. And they feed by firing a harpoon at their prey. And this harpoon is coated with poison. And what's amazing, I just learned this in the last year from my friend Toto Oliveira, is that each species makes a different harpoon, and they're just absolutely beautiful. So these are mature harpoons. Each species makes its own very distinctive harpoon. I guess not a surprise in evolutionary terms, Ed. Now, the species, the cone snails fire these harpoons, and they paralyze their prey, worms, fish, other mollusks. And it turns out the toxins that coat these harpoons, and there's a cocktail of them, not just one. There's a whole variety of different toxins. And each cone snail is thought to make 100 distinct toxins that no other cone snail species makes. Makes its own 100. There are 500 species, so the estimate is that there may be 50,000 different toxins in the cone snail genus. They're polypeptides. They're much like the toxins in scorpions and snakes and sea anemones and spiders. And they're enormously potent and enormously specific in binding to various receptor sites on essentially all animal cells, including almost all the receptors that we can identify in our own cells. They're extremely potent. Now, let me tell you about two of them. One is a calcium channel blocking peptide that binds to the pain fibers in what's called the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. This is a cross section of the spinal cord. It binds very specifically to pain fibers in the spinal cord, not to the fibers that are carrying fine touch or temperature, but very specifically to the pain fibers. And what's been amazing is that they've synthesized the compound called ziconotide, now called Prealt. It's been marketed and approved by the FDA. It's 1,000 times more potent than morphine as a painkiller. And it doesn't lead to either addiction or tolerance. One of the big problems with treating severe chronic pain is the fact that you many people quite quickly develop tolerance to the pain-killing effect. So tolerance means you have to keep giving more and more of the agent to get the same effect. And, of course, eventually you start running into severe side effects, such as respiratory arrest. It can be so you reach a threshold for many people, and they are still in pain. As you can imagine, there are enormous numbers of people in chronic pain around the world. So developing a compound that is a very effective painkiller that doesn't lead to tolerance is a huge, huge advance. Another conotoxin or conopeptide is being developed for epilepsy, and there are many other disease states that are being looked into. But cone snails live in coral reefs, largely in places like Indonesia and the Philippines, and coral reefs around the world are endangered. They're particularly threatened in these areas from a variety of reasons, but mostly from warming sea surface temperatures causing coral bleaching and lethal infections.
Dr. Eric Chivian speaking at the annual Harvard Medical School lectures on biodiversity and human health. This is where we find out how things like climate change and toxins affect not only our world, but our own selves personally. The lecture was given February 16, 2006. You can watch the full series of lectures in streaming video at chge.med.harvard.edu/education/course_2006.